Welcome back to another episode of Wise Words Book Summaries. Today we're doing Think Faster, Talk Smarter by Matt Abrahams. Matt Abrahams is an author, educator, and coach who specializes in communication strategies. Abraham teaches strategic communication at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. So his expertise is not just limited to speaking, but also includes nonverbal communication, listening skills, and effective presentation techniques, making him a respected figure in the field of communication, training, and education. So Think Faster, Talk Smarter is a great book on impromptu speaking, possibly the best I've ever read, that provides tips for giving toasts, making persuasive pitches, responding to tough questions, delivering feedback to others, and giving sincere apologies off the cuff. Some of the tips we will cover today include keeping speeches concise, creating an anxiety management plan, reframing your expectations, facilitating success for others, as well as multiple actionable frameworks to give you the confidence in any situation. These include the problem-solution-benefit strategy for pitches, answering questions with the ADD framework, and delivering sincere apologies using the AAA formula. So if you want to learn how to communicate better and feel more confident when put on the spot, this deep dive will reveal all the tactics, tips, and tricks you will need to completely change how you improvise. So let's get into it.
Okay, so into the introduction. So we start off with a quote by Mark Twain. It usually takes me more than 3 weeks to prepare a good impromptu speech. And I guess this kind of ties in with a lot of what we've been talking about in other communication books, but the idea of preparation. So what do you think? This question, while straightforward and seemingly harmless, often places us in a challenging position. The anticipation of others for our input can lead to feelings of discomfort, anxiety, or even fear. Being caught off guard by such questions can be daunting, pushing us into a space where we are expected to deliver a prompt, coherent, and somewhat engaging response. Our primary aim becomes avoiding embarrassment and showcasing our competence, which is, I think everyone can kind of relate to.
Yeah.
However, with a shift... Sorry, did you want to say something?
No. It's just so true, isn't it? It's almost like the goal shifts. It kind of reminds me of the Crucial Conversations where... Yeah, there's like a separate conversation going on in your head, and it's like, oh, how can I show off almost? How can I prove that I'm, you know, what I'm going to say is, you know, well thought out, and I've got it all together almost.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So, however, with a shift in perspective and the development of certain skills, we can transform into effective communicators during these unexpected high pressure moments. It's possible to not only handle such situations with ease, but to also find enjoyment in them. And I think that says a lot, because it's the whole like incentive and fear. It's like, okay, yes, we don't want to be stumbling over our words, but we also want an incentive to engage and be good communicators. And if we can find joy in conversing, not the sound of our own voices, then, you know, I think everyone can benefit from that. The key to excelling in impromptu speech lies in practice and preparation. With dedication to honing our communication skills, breaking free from ingrained habits, and making mindful choices, anyone can shine in spontaneous discussions. Ironically, preparing for these unpredictable moments enables us to express our thoughts and personality more fully. Imagine being at ease and confident in your ability to communicate on the fly. Picture a scenario where being asked to speak becomes an opportunity to engage, learn, and connect instead of a daunting challenge. Envision yourself communicating effortlessly without the usual nervousness and delivering your message in a clear, concise, and compelling manner. What if you can embrace these moments, thinking on your feet and speaking confidently under the spotlight? This book will teach you that.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? Because the secret to being good on the fly is preparing. it's kind of ironic, right? And it reminds me of the art of explanation, where, you know, the more preparation you put in, the more you kind of seem better at improv, just because you've got some ready-made structures, answers, you know, responses. They're not necessarily canned responses, but you kind of have this rough bullet point structure. Do you know, like we covered in the art of explanation. Just goes to show it, yeah. You know, the preparation matters.
Exactly.
So part one, the Think Faster, Talk Smarter methodology. So there's six steps to better spontaneous speaking. And the framework he mentions in the book is calm, unlock, redefine, listen, structure, and focus. And the following chapters basically take each one by one. So chapter one, calm, tame the anxiety beast. So improving spontaneous communication, or any communication, begins with managing the intense anxiety that often accompanies it. Anxiety can consume our focus, energy, and ability to respond effectively, leading to a self-reinforcing cycle of doubt and diminished confidence. The cycle can escalate to the point where we are overwhelmed in high-pressure situations. So here is a list of tricks and tips to combat this. So the first one is confronting anxiety. So address your anxiety directly by acknowledging its normalcy in high-stakes situations. Remind yourself that feeling nervous is a common reaction and it makes sense given the circumstances. Recognizing and naming your feelings can help you regain a sense of control and prevent you from being swept away by negative emotions. And then the second one links really closely to that. So it's the reframing of anxiety as excitement. So anxiety and excitement share similar physiological responses, placing us in a heightened state of alertness. So by reinterpreting anxiety as excitement, we gain control over our interpretation of the situation, transforming our speaking experience into one of empowerment. So that's just a classic example of, yeah, a reframe, a relabel. Because I remember in the book as well, he went into a bit more detail about how when you label things or feelings, you're kind of tapping into your more your prefrontal cortex, right? You're kind of getting away from that emotional part of the brain.
Absolutely. I think you're kind of building new associations, essentially. By reframing it, you can therefore start to label it with positive associations, and it becomes that kind of incentive, you know? It's something that's exciting and not fearful. I think that's incredibly powerful. And I think it just touches on a point that, you know, you have so much control. If you can tap into the ability to kind of rewire your brain in how you perceive things, and you get to control your perception, then yeah, the world is your oyster, because you can reframe anything to benefit you to some extent.
Yeah, no, 100%. The whole reframing is a benefit. You're right, because you know, the fact of feeling anxious just means that this moment is probably important to you. You know, it's not necessarily a bad feeling. It's just getting your body ready to be more alert. And it doesn't have to be a negative thing, just because we've got so many negative connotations associated with it. And we almost give it power by thinking it's a debilitating state, when it could just be, like you just said there, where if you maybe even, you know, confuse the terms. I'm sure there's people out there, right, who actually have anxiety, but they've never conceived of it as anxiety. They just call it a feeling that they feel, and they might use the word maybe excitement for it, or they're full of adrenaline potentially as well, or something. Like, they just define it in a different way, and therefore, to some extent, they have a different relationship with it.
I mean, take anything that you kind of start with, especially when you're like a kid and you've never done it before and you're a bit anxious about it, but then you do it. Like, let's say you go surfing, and the first time you go surfing, you're a bit anxious about it because you don't know how it's going to pan out. And then you end up loving it. And then the next time, you've got so much excitement about doing it. It's just, and so if you're able to reframe it as something that is exciting, and then you engage in it as if it is exciting, then it starts to rebrand that whole experience. You know what I mean?
I was even going to add there, it's not part of this book, but I'm pretty sure, I don't even know where I'm thinking this from, potentially a podcast I listen to, but the whole idea of overcoming anxiety and realizing that you can overcome it gives you more self-confidence, right? So then you believe in yourself more, like you feel better just from overcoming that anxiety. So maybe you could even reframe anxiety as like a challenge to overcome to build a stronger self. Like, this is the cost or the price I need to pay to build better self-confidence. Because the more you overcome that anxious feeling, you're going to realize you are not your anxiety, and that you can overcome it again and again and again, right? So if anything, it's, you can reframe it as, you know, almost like the growth emotion. You know, if I do it more and more again and again, I'm going to feel stronger and I feel like I've grown.
Yeah, 100%. That makes so much sense.
So yeah, on to the next couple of techniques then for their anxiety. So we got the breathing techniques for calmness. So deep controlled breathing is a proven method to reduce nervous symptoms. So practicing long inhalations followed by extended exhalations can calm the nervous system quickly, reducing heart rate and slowing speech. We come across this idea a lot, haven't we? Like the sort of Wim Hof sort of stuff, and breathing techniques have become all the rage these days. And it does just make sense, right? You're creating a sort of like physiological response, and your body can't help but be calmer if you're taking deeper breaths, right? Because part of the physiological immediate response to when you're scared or anxious is you start breathing quicker.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the next one, which is semi-linked, I really quite enjoyed this one. So it's the slow down physical movements. So for fast talkers like myself, slowing down physical gestures can help regulate speech. Our speech often synchronizes with our movements. So moderating gestures can lead to slower, clearer communication. And that one off the bat, I just think is so easy to do. If you just, I'm a fast speaker, you know, self-diagnosed, but I usually, you know, I want to move my hands like this, right? And it's the moment you start doing it slower, you can't help but slow down the way or the speed in which you're talking. So that's probably one of the most actionable tips in this book. It's just slow down everything.
No, it's so true. It's kind of funny how it does synchronize. Like, it makes so much sense because, you know, if someone was talking really quickly and their hands were going really slowly, it would just, there'd be a massive mismatch.
There'd be such a mismatch. So, you'd be like, this guy is a maniac. Like, what is going on with this person?
It would just throw you off.
Yeah, it would.
Yes, I think that's probably a very good point.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So yeah, moving on from that one, then we got the positive self-talk. So replacing negative internal monologues with positive affirmations, similar to techniques used by professional athletes so they can help focus the mind and reduce self-doubt. This mental shift allows for greater clarity and confidence. I mean, we've covered this in other books and stuff, but yeah, the idea of sort of like positive affirmations about yourself can obviously help you overcome. And to be honest, this probably links in a little bit with the whole reframing of anxiety. If you can just reaffirm again and again and again what anxiety is to you, this probably would help as well.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Once again, it builds all those positive associations, not only to yourself and how you perceive yourself, but also the experience that you're about to engage in.
Know exactly that, and framing it as like an opportunity or something like that. It's not something to be scared of. So yeah, this is one I quite liked as well. So strategies for memory lapses. So if you find yourself at loss for words, revisiting recent statements can provide a moment to regather your thoughts. So this technique, akin to retracing steps when searching for lost items, can help realign your train of thought and maintain audience engagement. So it's almost like if you've completely like, oh my God, I can't believe what, I don't know what I'm going to say next. You just kind of go back and repeat what you've just said in the hope that, you know, you refine your trail. But I thought it's quite a good one. And I do think maybe that, you know, when you see sometimes speakers who then say a sentence and then say it again, maybe for more rhetorical effect, but maybe it's just because they forgot what they were going to say next. So they just re-say the three things they just said before, like, this is great. And they're like, this is great.
Yeah, give it more emphasis while you're trying to find the words. Well, and I guess that also emphasizes the point of preparing, doesn't it?
For sure.
As in, like, if you've got a bit of a structure to something, then by retracing your steps, then you can start to figure out where you are in terms of your structure, and probably you have a higher likelihood of remembering what comes next.
Yeah, for sure. Especially in that, like, that blink of the moment where anxiety is really high, you know, the only thing you can focus on is probably like, oh my God, I've, you know, messed this up. At least maybe just going back, you said, and just saying the same thing again, you might be able to like calm yourself down to then re-find your place within the structure that you probably would have prepared if you're doing like a, you know, public speech or whatever.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So the last couple, so we've got the buying time with questions. This includes asking generic, contextually relevant questions, which can provide a brief respite, allowing you to collect your thoughts. This approach also engages your audience, shifting the focus and giving you a moment to regroup. So I feel like probably one of the best ways would be just a rhetorical question or something like that. Could it be like, are you guys all enjoying yourselves? maybe not so much that, but there's plenty of ways you can do that as well to try and refine or give yourself that space.
I want you to say that halfway through a conversation.
Well, I can say it for half through this, right? So are you guys all enjoying yourselves, listeners? And then you'll know
I was just going to say, in addition to buying yourself time, also, it, for instance, if from the previous point you've had like a memory lapse, it just it buys you time to think about something maybe more in clarity, like more clarity, and compose yourself. So you know, when you start to get to that point in a conversation where you're almost rushing and you're jumbled up because you've just caught up with it, whether you're excited about what you're talking about. But I feel like that kind of give you time to like make yourself composed and just reset it a bit.
Yeah, refine your control, maybe your momentum or something. If you got like a bit of out of pace too quick and you're just like, I need to slow down a little bit. Like, yeah, it does make sense. And he was recommending as well, maybe having some So obviously they were saying they're potentially having questions that are more relevant to the actual context of what you were just saying. But then also there's ones that you could do that maybe are more generic. You know, the one I said there, which was just, you know, bullshit anyway, but the whole, like, are you guys enjoying yourself sort of thing. But you can have your sort of canned questions that you could ask an audience, for example, or your conversational partner, which can kind of get you out of these situations where you realize, oh crap, I've forgotten what I was going to say, or I need to switch things up a little bit here. So yeah, you can prepare these almost in advance, right?
Yeah.
And then what else do we have here? So we have a few more. So we got perspectives on audience attention. So it's important to remember that audience members are often preoccupied with their own concerns and may not scrutinize us as closely as we fear. So this realization can help mitigate the pressure we place on ourselves. And it's that classic, like, most people there probably want you to like succeed when you're speaking. They don't want you to mess up because they probably feel that pang of anxiety and fear that you would fear in the same situation. So most people want things to go smoothly. They're usually rooting for you. And at the end of the day, they'll probably forget about if you make a cock up or whatever when you're speaking, and they're not going to remember it in a couple of days' time.
If even by that evening, you know, like,
yeah, no, 100%.
It's amazing how much we'll overthink these things. And most people, whether they even noticed it, whether they interpreted it in the way that we think they interpreted it. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's crazy how much we overthink things.
Yeah, 100%. And then one of the last ones, so is the managing the filler words. We've discussed this on pretty much every single communication book, has gone through it, and we still do it, and I'm trying my best not to, but the excessive use of filler words can be curbed through breathing techniques. So by aligning sentence endings with breath exhalation, we naturally reduce the occurrence of filler words, leading to a more polished and effective communication. There you go. See, it kind of works. If you breathe in at the very end of the sentence, you're less likely to go,
yep.
Or inhalation or exhale. Yeah. It kind of works. If you just try and think when you finish sentence, you're doing something involving your breath, you're less likely to be like, you know, still happens, right? And then one of the last notes I got here, because I took it mainly for myself, but people who are listening might be interested. So there's lots of softwares out there now which helps you to identify these ums and ahs and filler words you're doing. So I think I shared with you poise.com, didn't I? Then there's one called Ori and Like So. So these are all AI-driven softwares where you upload your video of you speaking, and it will count the amount of times you use filler words, and it'll kind of dissect and give you a speaking score, and you can use it to become, I guess, self-aware of the way you currently speak, as well as offer tips and tricks to improve. We haven't used it yet, but we'll probably run this podcast through it afterwards, aren't we? We're thinking about it and see what it can do.
Yeah, I think it sounds like quite a practical tool, like quite an efficient tool.
Yeah.
And obviously these things are never going to be 100% accurate, but the fact is that if they can point you in the right direction, then yeah, that's all you kind of need.
Yeah, I think also it was the words per minute. It counts like your speed of speech, which is something that I personally feel like I'm always speaking too quick, right? And it would be interesting just to see how fast it is in comparison to like a benchmark. And then also maybe noticing, because also there's certain things where I think he talks about later in the book where, you know, speaking quick isn't necessarily a bad thing. It just depends on what you're trying to say. Like if you're excited about something, you want to convey your excitement, you usually speak quicker, right? That's kind of like, it's not like you should completely get rid of speaking quick, but it's more like as a baseline, you should reduce it and then, you know, use it as a sort of rhetorical weapon, almost, so to speak, to show to people that you're really interested or excited about an idea.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, we've got a summary of the ideas we just covered. So I'll just do it as well. So these are nine summary techniques from this chapter. So you've got the whole practice, mindfulness. So confront and accept your emotions as they come, understanding that such reactions are both common and justified. Number two is breathe. So engage in deep breathing, allowing your abdomen to expand fully. Such breaths akin to those in yoga can mitigate feelings of anxiety. And the good rule of thumb is making your exhalations last twice the duration of your inhalations. Number three then is slow your movements, one of my personal favorites. So reduce the speed of your gestures, hand gestures and movements, since your speech rhythm often aligns with your physical actions. So slowing these down can similarly tranquilize your speech. Number four, and a fact I must have deleted it from the above, is really interesting. It was cool your body. So grasping a chilled water bottle, or any other cool item, as cooling down physically can lessen blushing and sweating, or one of the, you know, body's physiological responses to anxiety. But I don't know how many people, although on that note, he actually says actually a lot of his talks, he will make sure he has a cold water bottle before he goes on stage and he can hold it, which is quite interesting.
Interesting.
And then this next one as well, once again, I've got it in the summary, but less in the above because I thought it was a bit weird, but it apparently works. So salivate. So stimulate your salivary glands by chewing or sucking on a lozenge, which can alleviate dry mouth, which is associated with nervousness. Which is interesting.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
You get that a lot in acting as well.
You do?
They talk about that.
Well, they tell you to suck lozenges. Is that what they do?
Not that prescriptive, but they will say that, like, you know, if you've got a dry mouth, like, do certain exercises that, like, stimulate saliva.
Is that for nervousness or more for, like, speech?
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
I think it's a bit of both, probably.
Okay.
But yeah.
That's interesting that they say that, but yeah.
Funny.
Because then it's backed up by this guy. So 6 is positive self-talk. So silently repeat affirming mantras to yourself. Positive internal dialogue can help suppress self-critical thoughts and steer your mindset towards a more constructive direction. 7 is rewind and question to progress. It's okay to repeat prior statements or pose questions to your audience to reinforce your memory. However, be mindful not to overdo it. Use repetition sparingly as a tool for recollection and engagement. Then 8 is getting rational. So consider the most challenging outcome of a situation and remind yourself that even the worst case scenario, the implications are often less dire than imagined. Most people are preoccupied with their own concerns, likely paying less attention to your actions than you might fear. And the very last one is inhale to reduce fillers. So end sentences in a manner that requires you to inhale, naturally reducing the use of filler words such as like and okay. And this technique streamlines your speech, making it more fluent and effective. I think for me, my personal favorites are the inhaling at the end, because I know I've got a problem with the R.
Yeah, I think that's a very good one.
And I also do like the hand gestures. I think they're the two most actionable ones for me, but I feel like everybody will have different preferences. I mean, some of the other ones, like the saliva thing, is quite interesting. I personally never thought about chewing gum while I speak, but I think it's maybe more before.
Yes. Yeah. It's a good point, actually. Like, I'd never really thought about actively doing it, especially before talking, but you can see how it could kind of benefit you. So the next point is amp yourself up. So for effective management of anxiety symptoms, it's crucial to not only learn various techniques, but also ensure they become integral parts of your approach. After familiarizing yourself with different strategies, select those that resonate most with you to create what can be termed a personalized anxiety management plan, AMP, which is kind of like exactly what you were just saying just then. Like, you resonated with certain points more than others, and you could integrate those into your kind of AMP plan, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly that.
This plan, by enhancing your control and concentration, can invigorate and motivate you towards better handling speaking situations. Choose a set of 3 to 5 strategies that you feel are most effective for you, and specifically target the anxiety symptoms you frequently encounter. So examples of anxiety management plans are BOOM. So be present, which is concentrate on the current moment rather than fretting over what might go wrong in the future. Observe your actions, so decelerate your physical actions to help regulate the tempo of your speech. Then oxygenate your body, focus on deep breathing, ensuring your exhales are twice as long as your inhales. And M for mantra, so use affirming mantras or phrases to calm and center yourself, enhancing focus. And it makes sense that, like, you only choose a few. There's probably so many different ways to actually cope with your anxiety and flip it on its head. But if you were to take 10, then it's a bit overwhelming. You probably won't remember all of them. If you have like a nice little acronym, you know, or only a few to follow, it makes it much easier.
It makes sense to focus on the ones that you think are the most high leverage for yourself. So if you can identify yourself having the, you know, certain problems, I mean, like you said before, the ones that I mentioned that resonated with me is because I believe or I perceive myself as having the problems I said, and therefore these are the ones I think, wow, I need to use the most or remind myself of the most to handle those moments.
Yeah.
So yeah, it makes sense for everybody to pick, like you said, 3 to 5. You can obviously, you know, they had like, what were the names? This will be on the website, but you have stuff like salivate, positive self-talk, but you could even change the word to a synonym just so you can have a better, more memorable acronym? Because obviously Boom was pretty memorable, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
there to be played around with.
Yes, absolutely. Cool. And yeah, so that leads us on to the next chapter, which is Unlock. So the first was obviously, you know, taming the anxiety, and now we're unlocking. So maximize mediocrity. So aim for average. The pursuit of mediocrity is often frowned upon, as striving for excellence is the usual goal. However, when it comes to spontaneous communication, embracing a level of mediocrity can paradoxically elevate your speaking effectiveness. Allowing yourself to be mediocre frees you from the constraints of perfection, making you a more engaging and authentic speaker. And I guess this touches on a point like what do we see the ideal conversation as? You know, what is a successful conversation? You can look at it from multiple different perspectives. You know, do you want it? Is it just to get your point across? Is it to be authentic? Is it to be funny? Like, and I feel like because of that, there's no one particular like factor that we're looking for. So it can't be perfect, in which case just try and be authentic and engaging. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it just depends who you are, right? And what your purpose for the conversation is, right? You know, somebody who's going into a conversation as a salesperson, the definition of success and effectiveness is different to somebody who's going in just for a chinwag.
Absolutely.
And therefore there's never really the perfect, yes. You know, there's never the perfect approach. There's just the John Wick consequences.
John Wick consequences. Yeah, that is my mantra. In everyday tasks, we often strive for precision and accuracy. Yet in the fluid dynamics of spontaneous speaking, there is no singular correct or perfect approach, only varying degrees of effectiveness. Attempting to find the right way can actually inhibit our ability to connect with our audience and express ourselves genuinely. Do you want to read on to the heuristics?
Yeah, sure. So this next bit is about heuristics. So cognitive load theory suggests that our working memory has limited capacity. In our information-saturated environment, an overload of data can overwhelm this capacity, making learning and adapting more difficult. To cope, our brain utilizes shortcuts or heuristics, enabling us to navigate challenges more efficiently. These mental shortcuts are crucial in managing our desire for perfection and allowing us to embrace the effectiveness of simply being good enough. So heuristics play a crucial role in enabling us to make swift and effective decisions in complex scenarios, significantly reducing our cognitive load. Without these mental shortcuts, we'd find ourselves overwhelmed by the simplest decisions, like selecting spaghetti sauce at the grocery store, painstakingly weighing every option instead of applying a straightforward criteria like preferring an affordable organic option. But there is limitations with heuristics. So relying on heuristics comes with its drawbacks. Firstly, it can dampen our spontaneity and presence, especially in social interactions where nuances and individual needs might be overlooked. For instance, automatically providing feedback on a meeting without considering the specific context of the request can lead to missed emotional cues or unmet needs. Secondly, heuristics can stifle our creativity. Adhering to rule-bound thinking restricts our ability to conceive novel, imaginative responses, leading us to conventional solutions. So breaking free from these mental models can open up a wealth of creative possibilities and innovative solutions. And the thing I think of the most when I think of like heuristics is kind of the classic, hey, how are you? Yeah, I'm good. How are you? It's just, that's a heuristic everybody uses at the beginning of every conversation that you just, it almost means nothing. It doesn't mean anything anymore because everybody does it. It's almost like it's just the acknowledgement that you're even there. It's nothing more than that. You know, we've railed it
in the box,
for a while, right? And I'm guilty of it. I do it all the time still, but it's because it's the most canned response. And it's an acceptable response, right? You're not going to, so nobody's going to be like, what the hell is this guy on about? Like, I think I've used this guy's example before, but I remember my driving instructor. Every time I see him, like, how are you? I'm fucking amazing. I'm like, whoa, Jesus, that's strong. But I always remembered him. Every time he'd say something ridiculous, like, I am absolutely normal or something like that. And I'd be like, what? But it always got me, and I'm always like more intrigued by him. I still think about it now.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's just a lack of creativity in the sort of interactions we have, just because we always have the same canned response, because I guess we're afraid of, being weird, because it is pretty weird to reply in those ways. But I personally quite like it. It makes it more enjoyable in interaction, which isn't the standard you know, it's almost the reason why we don't like, or people don't like socializing too much, is because it's become too predictable, because everybody's too scared to, mm-hmm. you know, come outside of their shells or whatever.
Yes, I guess it requires good questions as well, right? Ones that don't lead, or maybe ones that break the mold that people don't have heuristics to, you know? There are probably ones that are more ingrained and we have a pattern of response. Whereas if you were to ask a question that's kind of a bit out there, then I wonder whether it requires a genuine response, you know, a unique and original response, because not many people have asked them that, for them to create a heuristic off the back of it.
But I'm also using the word heuristics interchangeably to like programmed behavior, programmed responses, you know. Because that's kind of what they are to some extent.
Yeah.
I don't feel like people are thinking they're using heuristics, but they are. It's almost exactly. like, it's almost, yeah, like you said, like a habit or like a behavior, like it's not. But this is kind of where, I mean, what we'll get onto it in a minute, where you can, you know, use them to your advantage to some extent, because you can set new rules, such as something like, my new heuristic is every time you ask me how I am, I'm going to say something that you'll never, like, I'm just going to be over the top or the opposite. Like, I'm exactly. so sad, and just keep a straight face, you know, that type of thing.
So,
strategies to counteract heuristic limitations. So to enhance our communication skills and creativity, it's not about completely abandoning heuristics, but becoming more conscious of when and how we use them. So recognizing the moments when heuristics might limit our responses allows us to pause, assess the situation afresh, and possibly take a more thoughtful, tailored approach. Staying vigilant for signs of heuristic reliance, especially under stress or when faced with a multitude of choices, can help us identify opportunities to break from our automatic responses. So experimenting with different perspectives or approaches, akin to an athlete training with a non-dominant hand, can disrupt habitual patterns and foster new ways of thinking and responding. So, balancing heuristic use. While heuristics are invaluable for navigating daily life efficiently, recognizing their limitations in certain contexts is key. So by remaining open to questioning our automatic responses and embracing more adaptive, flexible approaches, we can enhance our ability to engage more creatively and meaningfully in spontaneous situations. This balanced approach allows us to preserve the benefits of heuristics while mitigating their constraints, leading to richer, more inventive interactions and solutions. And that does just make sense, right? It's like using the structure, but allowing a little bit of freedom to sort of not reinvent, but just, you know, add a little bit of spice to an interaction, yeah. right? You're not like trying to change it completely, because if you spoke complete gobbledygook, they're just going to look at you like you're, you know, the weirdest person on the planet. But if you can just change a few words here and there and just get outside that sort of canned response that we all do. I mean, it's like emails, man. Like we always put like our kind regards, what else we put, best wishes, all that sort of stuff. It's stuff that could just, you know, break the pattern that people are used to, right? I think people I mean, what else is, like, people love comedy for that exact reason. Just break the patterns people expect.
Absolutely. I think it's crucial. If you want someone's attention, that is, that, you know, that's the best way to go about it. So, self-imposed standards. In Matt Abraham's class, there was an instance where a student during a game of Shout the Wrong Name found himself unable to participate as expected. Despite the simplicity of the game, where the objective was to incorrectly name objects, this student was caught in a loop of indecision, unable to voice even one incorrect name. He stood there, pointing at the same object repeatedly, struggling to break free from his internal constraints. When questioned about his hesitation, he revealed his difficulty in bypassing his self-imposed standards to find the right wrong name, indicating a deep-seated habit of evaluating and dismissing potential responses based on a personal set of criteria. This example highlights a broader tendency to self-evaluate and seek perfection as a means to mitigate feelings of uncertainty and gain a semblance of control in unpredictable situations. Such self-judgment, while offering a temporary sense of command, often stems from a desire to manage the unpredictable elements of life, from speaking in public settings to navigating important meetings. This behavior suggests a deeper psychological strategy to cope with vulnerability by obsessing over performance, even when outcomes remain largely unpredictable. And I think we can all kind of relate to this on some degree. You know, we're, I think, a especially the way that we're educated in this country, you know, you're not supposed to admit mistakes, and therefore you're looking for the right answer all the time, which can, you know, if you exaggerate that, it's basically just like to be perfect, like perfectionism. And we always want the right answer, you know, no matter what. And it's funny, even in like, you know, very creative exercises, and apparently kids really struggle with this. You know, they're given an exercise to do something, because like in class, where they don't, there isn't a right answer, and yet they all like freeze because they still are looking for that right answer. Yeah.
Tiva, this is one of my like key ideas from this book, was this idea of, you know, watching and trying to become aware of your own self-imposed standards. Especially in this game, the whole, you know, identifying the, you know, shouting the wrong name. Sorry, so I've got like a candle in front of me, is like me pointing at it, being like orange. That's the first thing that came to my head, right? But then one of the things that, let's just say I was in a group, I can do it now because it's like I'd feel like less pressure when it's just like a camera and you, right? But if it's in a group, I think one of the internal monologues in my head would be the right wrong name for me would probably be something that's a bit funny. You know, I try and find an angle that's funny. But if you put that pressure on yourself, then you're unwilling to say a lot of the ideas that come to your head because you don't think they're funny. But the reality is they might be, because the whole point of it is you're calling something like you're calling a spade, I don't know, a Sudoku puzzle. You know, it's so weird and bizarre that it might actually be funny. But you hold yourself to a standard of like, I need to make people laugh. Or maybe you don't even realize you have these standards until you're in that situation. And you're like, actually, the thing that's holding me back now is my criteria is I want people to respond to me in a way that they're, you know, they think I'm funny, or they want to respond in a way that they think I'm smart. Let's just say that might be the internal criteria people have. And I wonder actually, now that I'm saying this, how much people's personal identities would be mixed up, in their criteria of judgment. It's like, I want to be seen as smart, so therefore what I want to say is going to be filtered through my criteria of what I think smart is, or filtered through my criteria of what I think is funny. But we all have that because we all value different things. We all want to prove to other people that we're certain things, right? So in a, like, even what we were saying at the very beginning of this is like, what do you want from this conversation? Usually people go back into themselves, but like, I want to impress you. But like, there's a criteria of what the impressing is. Do I want to become across as smart, as funny? Do I want to come across as, you know, a joker, serious, whatever? And it's quite interesting to become aware of your own self-imposed standards. Because once again, there's no such thing as like a right answer to the right wrong name. Like, all of it is wrong. So if you call it a wrong, anything you don't call by his actual name is technically the way you play the game, but you've created this whole criteria of why your answer is wrong in comparison to another one, which just is not, you know, it's not the aim.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think by filtering everything through your own criterion, then you end up neglecting or diverting anything else that could be beneficial along the way because it doesn't fit with your criteria. You know, like if you're trying to, like you said, if you're trying to impress someone intellectually and yet there is an opportunity to be humorous, but you're not even aware of that because you're focusing on the intellectual aspects of it. And so almost staying open and not trying to assimilate a conversation into a particular like form or criteria, I think is very important. Yeah,
for sure. Did you want me to take the next bit?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So the next part is dare to be dull. So how can we minimize self-criticism and this constant pursuit of perfection in our communication? Well, a surprisingly simple yet profound strategy is to grant ourselves the liberty to perform tasks as they come without overthinking. This approach is a fundamental principle in improvisational theatre. Seasoned improvisers overcome their quest for perfection by embracing the mindset that good enough is great and encouraging themselves to dare to be dull. This philosophy underlines that by allowing oneself to be less than perfect, we ironically increase our chances of being engaging and authentic. As Dan Klein, an expert in improvisation, elucidates, striving for originality often leads to a paradox where efforts blend into a sea of attempts at uniqueness. In contrast, being straightforward and genuine, embracing the ordinary, often leads to the most authentic and compelling form of expression. So once again, it kind of reminds me of the whole sort of like, you're trying too hard. You know, there's a reason why that's a phrase. You're trying too hard to hit this criteria. It's the effortlessness in most of the case that make art or the expression and the authenticity of people like more true, if that makes sense. Like if you're seen to be trying so hard to be creative or intelligent or funny, you're not these things. because it has to be effortless. It has to come about naturally. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it's almost it's the nature of them to be effortless. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes
but
sense.
I almost feel like as well, because it's a classic where they've tried so many times and got not being funny so many times or not being smart, whatever it is you're looking for, that eventually they've learned how to be more funny, and therefore they can get away with making it effortless because they don't have to try anymore because they've failed so many times or they've tried a million times, and eventually they've got to the point where they understand what it is.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yes, no, 100%.
Then we've got reframing mistakes. So viewing mistakes as part of the process, akin to missed takes in film production, can lessen the burden of striving for flawless communication. This reframe helps us to see errors not as failures, but as stepping stones toward genuine and impactful interactions. So even in professional settings, embracing and learning from mistakes can significantly contribute to a culture of innovation and continuous improvement. A practical example of this approach was implemented in the software company through the introduction of Failure Fridays. So on these days, the entire organization gathered for a communal lunch during which individuals shared personal setbacks. The most insightful failure was recognized with an award aiming to destigmatize mistakes, encourage risk-taking, and foster collective learning. I thought that's quite an interesting reframe, and I quite like the idea, maybe, you know, in the future with kids or whatever, you have like a, Failure Fridays. Like, so what did you mess up this week? You know, that type of thing. What went wrong? Allowing people to realize that it's not actually, you know, embarrassing, I guess, to say you've had a setback or you failed at something.
It's normal.
Yeah.
All right, so shift to conversation. Shifting our perception of spontaneous interactions from performances to more natural conversations can also alleviate pressure. Unlike performances that often demand rehearsal and perfection, conversations flow more naturally, focusing on connection rather than an avoidance of errors. While vulnerability may still be present, it is substantially less intense than informal performance contexts, allowing for a more genuine and relaxed exchange. To transition communication towards a conversational model, several adjustments can be made. 1. Language use. Often the spotlight compels us to adopt formal and detached tone. Opting for warmer and more engaging language can make interactions feel more genuine and less staged. 2. Incorporating questions. Utilizing questions fosters a dialogue, transforming a monologue into an interactive exchange. This not only makes the conversation more engaging, but also positions statements as responses to implicit inquiries, enhancing the flow of dialogue. And lastly, avoiding over-memorization. Preparing impromptu speaking situations by memorizing responses can lead to increased anxiety over deviations from the script. Instead, organizing thoughts into a concise outline allows for flexibility and spontaneity, focusing on the essence of the message rather than a word-for-word delivery. This approach encourages a deeper engagement with the material and facilitates a more natural and conversational style of communication.
So to summarize the chapter, we've got 7 techniques to embrace your mediocrity. So number 1 is being alert to heuristics. So you want to be aware of when you're relying on your heuristics. So often triggered by stress factors like hunger, fatigue, or irritation, slowing down and reflecting enhances originality and connection. Number 2 is daring to be dull. So forget about achieving perfection. Adopt a more straightforward approach of action without overthinking. This mindset frees you up for greater creativity and spontaneity. Number 3, embrace your mistakes. So viewing mistakes as valuable steps towards your goals, akin to outtakes in a film production, this perspective will shift how you perceive setbacks, enriching your growth journey. Number 4 is frame as conversations. Understand that you're likely your harshest critic and that others are not as judgmental as you may fear. Approaching interactions as casual conversations rather than formal performances can significantly ease your communication. 5, choose informality. Adopting a more relaxed and approachable tone can transform perceived performances into engaging conversations, making interactions feel more personal and genuine. Number 6 is dialogue, not monologue. Shift from being the sole source of information to engaging in dialogue. Asking questions and fostering a back and forth enriches communication, making it more dynamic and enjoyable. And the very last one is off the cuff is best. So instead of memorizing speeches or responses, prepare your key points or cues. This approach reduces cognitive strain and promotes more natural and engaging delivery, similar to the art of explanation, which recommended sort of the bullet point memorization rather than, you know, word for word speech memorization.
All right. So moving on to chapter three. So redefine. So mind your mindset. So the challenge of impromptu communication often causes us to perceive it as a threat, a battleground where we must safeguard our ideas. This defensive stance not only drains our energy meant for dynamic and passionate communication, but also triggers negative emotional and physical cues, leading to a mindset that is more closed off than open and receptive. However, by shifting our perspective to view spontaneous communication as an enriching opportunity, we open ourselves up to a more relaxed and engaging interaction. This mindset allows our true personalities to emerge and makes the communication process enjoyable, broadening our horizons to embrace a diverse array of ideas. The apprehension of facing criticism or interruption during our discourse is common. We fear these interruptions might derail our thoughts, embarrass us, or expose gaps in our reasoning. Yet Trevor Wallace, a renowned comedian and social media influencer, sees such interruptions not as disruptions, but as unique opportunities that add an irreplaceable dynamic to the interaction. He leans into these moments, engaging with them, with the detractors to uncover unexpected and often enlightening paths. Building on the insights from Alaia Krum, a Stanford psychologist who specializes in how our perception shapes our experiences, it's beneficial to adopt a series of mindset shifts. These shifts transform our approach to spontaneous communication, guiding us from a place of apprehension to one of anticipation and engagement, enhancing both our delivery and our connection with the audience. I mean, yeah, it's very straightforward. It's kind of what we talked about before in terms of, mindset? Yes, yeah. Mind-wise.
Funny Carol enough, Dweck. Carol Dweck is literally mentioned in the first mindset shift. Literally.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, yeah, take it away then.
So, literally, funny enough, is mind shift number one is from fixed to growth. So the distinction between fixed and growth mindsets, as outlined by psychologist Carol Dweck, offers a profound insight into how we perceive our abilities and potential. A fixed mindset, as covered before, views our intelligence and skills as static attributes. We either possess them or we don't. Conversely, a growth mindset embraces the possibility of development, suggesting that our capabilities and understanding can evolve over time through effort and experience. So Dweck's research underscores the significant advantage of adopting a growth mindset, particularly in how we approach challenges and opportunities for personal advancement. Individuals who see themselves as capable of growth and learning tend to achieve more success, especially in communication. Studies indicate that those with a growth mindset experience less anxiety about public speaking, have a higher self-assessment of their communication skills, and engage more deeply with the nuances and effects of their speech. When faced with difficulties in communication, embracing a not-yet perspective can be transformative. This mindset implies that while you may have not mastered all facets of impromptu speaking, the potential for mastery remains open. It's a matter of time and effort, not a fixed limitation. So adopting this not yet stance encourages self-reflection and the pursuit of constructive questions that can guide personal growth and improvement in communication. And I really like the whole not yet, because it's a really simple, you know, two-word phrase that, you know, can apply to everything. Yeah. Oh, how's that? Like, you know, you're not very good at this. Oh, not yet. I'm not very good at this, but not yet. It's an empowering phrase.
Absolutely. It just tells you that there's a lot of potential out there that it's not fixed. all right. So then mindset shift two, from thinking about you to thinking about your audience. Often when faced with the challenge of impromptu speaking, our instinct is to internalize the pressure, viewing the situation as a personal test. This perspective puts us in a defensive stance, with our attention hyper-focused on our performance and response to perceived scrutiny. However, a pivotal shift in perspective involves redirecting our focus from ourselves to our audience. It's helpful to recognize that contrary to our fears, the majority of our listeners are rooting for us. They are not seeking discomfort or failure. Rather, they are hopeful for the positive and engaging exchange. The reality is that most people prefer to avoid the discomfort of witnessing social awkwardness in others and are inclined towards a seamless and pleasant interaction. By concentrating on the audience's perspective and their desire for a successful communication, we can alleviate some of the self-imposed pressure and approach the situation with a more outward-looking and empathetic mindset. This approach not only helps in reducing our anxiety, but also enhances our ability to connect with and respond to our audience effectively. I mean, and that's very straightforward. You're essentially just taking off the pressure. You're not seeing it just all based on you. You're considering multiple different factors, which is just how communication goes most of the time. It's just a lot of the time we're very like egocentric and we think about everything from our perspective and not others.
Yeah, I feel like most of the time when people hear you speak, they're probably just thinking more like less judgments about you and more like, why should I care about the information you're telling me? You know, like, what am I going to get out of this?
Yeah.
Rather than, oh, this guy, you know, like looks stupid or whatever, or sounds stupid or, the, you know, I mean, that does happen, but it's less.
It does.
Unless you've got a really squeaky voice like a guy from Grown Ups, then you should be fine.
Yeah.
What's up, ladies?
Oh, bless.
Yeah, not doing anything like that.
I think he died recently.
Oh, good. Did he really? That the actor?
Did you just say, oh, good?
No, I said, oh, shit. I did not say, oh, good. Did I? I mean, Tiva, I'm on camera, so maybe if I did, I can't remember. I definitely said, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I think I've read something somewhere that he died. The really ripped guy who's from Saskatchewan.
That's the one. That is the one.
Yeah. Weird. All right, so then mindset shift three. From yes, but, or no, to yes, and. And I'll take this one because it's about improvised theater, improvised acting. We often find ourselves resisting suggestions from others, either outright rejecting them with a no, or qualifying our acceptance with a yes, but. See, this habit leads to objections, critiques, and conditions that stifle further discussion. Adopting the yes and mindset from improvisational theatre encourages us to accept what's presented and then contribute our own ideas to it. This approach eliminates the notion of right or wrong responses, focusing instead on the evolving the conversation with each new contribution. Yes, and is not only simple, but also profoundly effective in fostering creativity and openness. To incorporate yes, and in spontaneous conversations, start by identifying and building on common ground, even in disagreements. Regularly revisiting these points of agreement can create a positive feedback loop, encouraging mutual understanding and collaboration. Be mindful of your biases and avoid hastily dismissing others' ideas. Quick interruptions or dismissals can make people feel overlooked and undervalued. Emphasizing a yes and attitude helps create an inclusive environment where every contribution is valued and built upon. Yes, I can vouch for that. I think it does work. I mean, it's literally what you're taught in improvisation, but in improv. But yeah, I think it's powerful. Powerful strategy.
Well, I think one of the classic reasons for why it's so powerful, especially maybe in a position where you're going to disagree with somebody, is the whole idea of yes, but is the idea that the but negates the yes. As soon as they hear the but, they're like, well,
yes.
They didn't even mean yes in the first place. Whereas at least if you say yes and, they kind of, you know, they basically subconsciously realized or perceive that you agree with them before you add maybe a potential rebuttal or you know, maybe a caveat to like, yes, you're completely right. And I would just like to add that this other thing over here, which you didn't mention, is also true, kind of thing. It gives you more wiggle room because people don't like to be told they're wrong, right? And the whole yes, but there's no point in saying yes for you to say that.
Exactly.
So,
do you want to go for this last one?
Yeah. So mindset. Jesus
Christ. I know, I keep saying that as well. Yeah.
I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's my writing. Right. Mindset shift. I think it's the shift part, the mindset. Anyway, mindset shift four.
Yeah.
That's a tongue twister. From dwelling on what happened to next play. So when encountering a mistake, the focus could shift towards the next action rather than dwelling on the misstep itself. This approach not only demonstrates resilience, but it also is likely to earn appreciation for one's fortitude. It's the recovery and response to a mistake that truly matters and is within one's control, rather than the mistake itself. So echoing this sentiment, Duke University's renowned basketball coach, Mike Krzyzewski, I'm assuming, known as Coach K, emphasizes, not to be confused with Kim K, emphasizes the next play philosophy, widely adopted in sports. This mindset encourages moving past a missed shot in basketball, a strikeout in baseball, or an interception in football, and immediately refocusing on the forthcoming opportunity. The essence of the next play concept is about readiness to embrace the next opportunity without being hindered by previous setbacks. Dwelling on past mistakes can obscure the potential that the present moment holds. By disciplining oneself to swiftly transition to the next play, regardless of the preceding events, one stays open and prepared for what comes next. Life's outcomes, whether seemingly positive or negative, are unpredictable in their ultimate impact. So what may initially appear as a setback could later emerge as an advantage, and vice versa. Hence, it is beneficial to not linger on past results, but to maintain focus on overarching goals. So in the moments of a setback, adopting the mindset of maybe, followed by a prompt move to the next opportunity, can be a practical way to navigate through challenges. Or next play, right? I like that a lot. I think it obviously doesn't just account for communication. Like any setback in life, right? The mindset of, that must be really shit that happened to you. Or maybe. Because it might, you know, offer you some other opportunity to do something else. A classic example, obviously, with me with the ACL stuff. Oh shit, you can't play football for a year. Oh, maybe it is, but I've managed to do more gym because of the fact that I'm not playing football. So it's like, yeah, it's bad in that aspect, but maybe it's not so bad in this other aspect. And you can't, you know, it's not like a blanket judgment of this is bad or good. It's like, oh, maybe it's good, maybe it's bad, but we'll find out. We can only take, you know, take the next step, the next play. And I love that as a philosophy. I think just those two words, next play, is super useful in life. Like if you can have that mindset, that everything's just the next play, like you can't obviously change the past, you know, me sitting here complaining about it isn't going to change it. Obviously learning from it's important, but that's where the whole next play comes in. Next play, but with the knowledge of what didn't work.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I think that's important to take with you. You don't just leave it there.
Yeah.
You reflect on it.
It's not you just don't. Yeah. Don't listen
you
to
would
it.
Only
yeah.
But you only reflect on it because you know that there is a next play.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole concept of reflecting is so that you can then therefore implement it into the next game. So it's important to learn from it, but you don't need to, you know, there's always tomorrow.
I still, it's kind of linked to this, and we will get around to doing this book in the communication, like book reviews that we're kind of doing at the moment, which is the Thank You for Arguing, I think, by Jay Heinrich. And he talks a lot about in the argument space that I want to say it's the past for definite is the blame frame. Because if you're ever focusing on the past, you're always trying to find somebody to blame, somebody who caused it, right? The present, I think he also refers to as similar to the blame frame. And then he talks a lot about the only constructive arguments you can really have is the future frame, which is solutions. Like, oh, what are we going to do about it kind of thing.
Yeah.
I kind of think about it a lot here with the next play. It's like by focusing on the future, you are controlling what you can do next and not on the past. Because obviously focusing on the past, it's just a blame game. It's like, oh, whose fault was it? Why did that happen? It's not going to change the fact that everything happened. And that's why I find it so interesting. It's like if you spend your whole time.
Exactly.
And it's obviously there is a reason and you should obviously reflect upon past mistakes. Like you have to look back and go like, oh, is that my fault? It is my fault. I should have done better. But at the same time, it's not going to help you do the next play. Or it might help you inform to do the next play, but you've got to focus on what you can do next. Rather than, oh, I'm just going to live in the past and suffer.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I agree.
Cool. So we're on to chapter 4, which is listen. Don't just do something, stand there. And by the way, that is not a typo. I believe that's what his chapter is called. And the more I look at that, the more I think it doesn't make sense. But it's going to when we finish the chapter. So we so often miss opportunities during spontaneous encounters to look for signs of what others around us are thinking, feeling, and needing. Often we miss these opportunities due to noise in three categories. So you've got physical, physiological, and psychological. So these are the three P's that impede us from listening well. One, like we just said, physical noise, pretty obvious. It's, you know, dropping something on the floor. Two, physiological noise, so fatigue, hunger, and anxiety. And then three, psychological noise, so your biases, judgments, and rehearsals. So the power of listening. Attentive listening extends beyond hearing words to include the observation of nonverbal cues and the context of the conversation. It involves tuning into the audience reactions, the influence of their social environment on the interaction, and discerning what aspects of our communication are making an impact versus those that are not. It's about capturing the subtle signals that reveal the audience's current emotions and needs. Neglecting to listen can lead to missed opportunities and can inadvertently create issues, resulting in communication that may seem discordant, insensitive, or inappropriate to our audience. Instances of not listening in everyday interactions can lead to unintended consequences. So, for example, endorsing an idea without fully understanding the team's perspective on its viability, offering solutions to a partner who simply needs to express their feelings, or misinterpreting friendly gestures as romantic interest. These scenarios underscore the importance of listening, not just to respond, but to understand and connect more deeply with others. I'm sure some of those examples you just gave, plenty of people have, made mistakes in these areas. The classic, somebody's coming to you not for a solution, just to be listened to, And I think that happens more than we care to admit.
Yes, well, I think there's always those like two factors, isn't it? It's like, do you want support, like emotional support, or do you want a solution? And sometimes, you have to kind of gauge what people want.
What do you want? Tell me what you want.
All right, so framework for engaging more deeply. Drawing from the insights of Collins Dobbs, a Stanford lecturer and former college basketball player, a practical framework named Pace, Space, and Grace has been developed to navigate challenging interactions effectively. This approach encourages us to slow down, consider others' perspectives, and tap into our intuition. So, pace yourself. Rapid living leads to rapid thinking and responding. By deliberately slowing down, we open ourselves up to messages and nuances we might otherwise overlook. For instance, Deborah Schifrin, a former NPR journalist, uses the killer last question strategy during interviews to uncover any overlooked topics, demonstrating the value of pausing and engaging fully. Practical actions to decelerate include putting away distractions, practicing deep breathing, and adopting supportive mantras. This slower pace fosters more focused listening, allows for better eye contact, meaningful nods, and thoughtful reflections. It's also important to choose the right moments for conversations, avoiding times when distractions are likely. So that was pace yourself. And now number two is create reflective space. So gaining clarity often requires asking probing questions like, what makes you believe this? Or how does this impact you? Such inquiries not only demonstrate curiosity, but also courage, as they open up new directions for dialogue. Paraphrasing what has been shared, rather than repeating it verbatim, helps to distill the conversation's essence. Additionally, exploring what hasn't been said can reveal underlying emotions or concerns, enriching the dialogue and deepening understanding. And lastly, we have offer grace. So according to interpersonal relationship expert David Bradford and Carol Robin, effective communication involves tuning into both internal and external dialogues, acknowledging our internal responses and allowing them to guide our interactions can lead to more authentic and connected exchanges. Recognizing and expressing our emotions during conversations, such as sharing how a topic makes us feel, encourages openness and vulnerability, fostering deeper connections. By applying the principles of pace, space, and grace, we can transform our approach to spontaneous speaking, leading to more meaningful and engaging interactions. And I think a lot of this is basically just tuning into the other person, actually being like quite receptive and quite open.
And patient.
So that, we never know where a conversation is going to go. And the it constantly flows in different ways. And if you're open to that, then you can go with the natural flow. And by having pace, space, and grace, that's kind of just like, a tactic that allows you to do that.
Yeah, this the pace, space, and grace sort of idea reflects some of the ideas from I want to say it was nonviolent communication. maybe one of the other ideas, especially the grace part. So the whole sort of like allowing your feelings to be communicated in the topic. So like, this is how what we're talking about makes me feel, you know, not being afraid to allow your feelings to come to the topic of conversation, as well as, I like the idea as well of the creating reflective space, you know, sort of like asking a question that's quite tough, but then also not answering it for them, which I'm terribly bad at, but having the ability to just pause and give people time to answer. Because obviously, you know, people struggle with the uncomfortability of silence, but giving them the space to, you know, you've asked them a tough question and not jumping in and helping them reply.
Exactly. It's really listening to your partner, your conversation partner, on multiple levels, not just the superficial text level. You know, it's being in tune with them and their emotions.
Yeah, exactly. Like, listen, it's funny, isn't it? Because everybody thinks listening is just, you know, the through your ears, but it's actually through your sight as well.
Absolutely.
So yeah, there's this next bit that I've put in a green little box because it was actionable. So it's some of the ideas he said to do it. So now that you've experienced with asking clarifying questions to create space for listening, prepare some of these questions in advance. So examples might be, can you provide more specific detail? Can you share with me some of your experience with this? How does this apply to what you're currently working on? And how can this help you and others? So sort of stock questions like this, which encourages people to continue on speaking about what they're speaking about, will improve your sort of listening skills because you'll be able to get more personal responses to some of these. This is probably my favorite chapter. So chapter 5, which is structure. So structuring your spontaneity. So to talk effectively on the spot, it's helpful to have some rules and methods in place. This doesn't mean we need to script everything or memorize lines, but rather have a basic plan that makes it easier to get our point across clearly and quickly. So thinking about how to organize our thoughts is a good first step. Having a clear plan for how to share our ideas helps us speak more smoothly and make sense to others. Telling people the plan at the start, like a tour guide, would and should make it easier for them to follow what you're saying. So having a plan doesn't stop us from being spontaneous. Just like jazz musicians who improvise within a set musical structure, we can be creative within our conversation frameworks. We can get ready for different types of talks by coming up with a few simple and flexible plans. This helps us handle unexpected conversations better, making our points clearly without needing a script. But it's crucial to remember that just listing points isn't enough. Effective communication needs a story-like structure with a clear beginning, middle, and end, not just a bunch of items. Using this storytelling approach makes our spontaneous talks more engaging and meaningful, creating a real connection with our audience instead of just listing facts. And this, once again, is similar to the idea earlier, which is the best spontaneity or spontaneous conversations usually come with, I was going to say weeks, maybe not weeks, but preparation, days of preparation, or at least practicing beforehand, not necessarily canned responses, but knowing the structures of the ways or the way you're going to, the way you're going to structure the content of what you're going to say. And as we'll see at the end of this chapter, he gives you some ready-made structures for different scenarios, such as, you know, one for when you're pitching, one for, I think one of them is a more like all purpose general Swiss Army knife approach, he says, to whatever you're going to say. But then you've got ones for apologies. And it just allows you to tick off one of the two main problems, which you're going into in a minute, which is you have two problems, is what to say and how to say it. And he's like, well, with these structures, what you get is you've ticked off the box of how to say it. You just need to know now what to put in the structure, which I think is super useful. And it's something before this book I hadn't even contemplated. Exactly. But if there's anything I've took away for this book is the idea of being able to pre-structure the way you're going to go about explaining something, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you always need a bit of a structure. I think it should be a loose structure. You know, you never know how your conversation is going to pan out. But if you have a loose structure that you can follow and that you can get back to if you need to, then you'll always have a bit of a direction that you can rely on. And then obviously part of that structure is usually a kind of narrative in some form, you know, some kind of story structure, which lends more, he'll tell us now.
So,
the four benefits of structure. So As a speaker and speaking coach, Matt Abrahams has identified that structuring presentations brings significant advantages. Number one, firstly, organizing information into a coherent story not only maintains the audience's focus, but also piques their interest. A story format naturally guides listeners through content, enabling smooth transitions between ideas. Without clear narrative connections, speakers might rely too much on filter words like next and so, which suggests a lack of a cohesive story to tie the information together. A structured approach, such as the problem-solution-benefit framework, encourages clear transitions that enhance understanding. For example, by stating, "Now that we have a firm understanding of the problem at hand, allow me to share how we can solve it through a simple investment." And then on to number two. So, structure aids in memory retention for both the speaker and the audience. Humans generally struggle to remember information. Our capacity for holding distinct pieces of information is limited, and we're even less adept at recalling complex concepts. Our brains default to fade to gist, remembering the essence while forgetting the details. However, we are wired to seek, enjoy, and remember stories, with scientists referring to our capacity for recalling past events as episodic memory, framing our recollections as narratives. According to Stanford neurologist Frank Longo, narratives are powerful because they can evoke emotions, making the information more memorable and interesting. Emotional engagement activates the brain's attention and memory circuits, enhancing the impact of the storytelling. And we kind of touched on that in the Art of Explanation, didn't we, when we were talking about the different ways to structure stories, essentially, and the benefits of them. Okay, so then on to number three. So the third advantage of using a structure beyond enhancing engagement and improving memory is that it simplifies the way we process information. This is achieved by clearly indicating the structure to our audience, guiding them as they absorb the details. Experts often discuss processing fluency, which refers to the ease with which our brains can understand and store information. Our brains require effort to interpret and organize scattered bits of data. By applying a structured approach, we can increase processing fluency, making it less challenging for our audience to grasp and connect the information presented. And then lastly, number four. So the fourth advantage of structure is its influence on our own thought process, in addition to shaping how our audience interpret our messages. The structure we select as speakers frames our approach to the content we plan to discuss. Consider being in a college literature class where the professor asks for your thoughts on the week's assignment, Shakespeare's The Tempest. You might decide to compare it with another Shakespeare play read previously, organizing your thoughts around a structure of comparison, contrast, conclusion. Without this specific framework, your analysis might not have honed in on the parallels and distinctions between the two works. Utilizing structure disciplines our thought process. It encourages us to follow a logical path, keeping our arguments focused and coherent. This not only guides what we choose to express, but also clarifies what we opt to exclude, ensuring our discussions are structured and meaningful.
Yeah. I mean, that last one is really important, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if somebody who's like, you know, if you're going to write an essay, let's just say, the way you go about your argument, right? Especially with that comparison, contrast, conclusion. I think that's really interesting because you're right. If you don't focus on that as like a framework, you might not even bring into your analysis the parallels that you could draw because you'd be focusing on something else maybe, let's just say. And I think that's really interesting because it does focus your attention. But then obviously because your attention's focused, it probably makes the argument more logical and watertight than if you're sort of all over the place. You know, at least people know when they're reading it, it's going to be a comparison, contrast, like argument kind of thing.
Mm, yeah, exactly.
It does make sense. And I think it's funny, isn't it? In hindsight, I wish I had more structures maybe readily available for uni. I know they gave you sort of like the classic, didn't they? What was it like? Thesis, analysis, synthesis, I think, isn't it? Like the classic sort of frame for doing like an essay in general, especially when you're reading around a topic, but it's just quite interesting how the same can apply to when you're just, yeah, you're speaking spontaneously. Okay, like, oh, I'm going to compare these two options to you right now, but the way I'm going to do it is comparison, contrast, and then I'm going to conclude. I wouldn't have thought about that before. I just kind of just jump into it without any idea of how I was going to structure what I was going to say and just ramble on almost, you know?
Absolutely.
So yeah, moving on to some of the next parts. So I did mention this earlier, but structure solves one of the two big problems with spontaneous communication. So in spontaneous situations, we face two primary challenges: deciding what to say and determining how to say it. Adopting a structured approach addresses the how to say it aspect and also helps us clarify what to say. For example, using a logical structure in storytelling guides us through the beginning, middle, and end of our narrative, allowing us to track our progress and direction. This structure liberates us to focus on crafting the content of our message. So now moving on to some of these structures, I'm sure people are actually now probably interested in learning a few of them. So we got structures for different occasions. So when considering the topic and audience, Matt Abrahams evaluates the use of different structural approaches, such as the persuasive problem solution benefit, the chronological past, present, future, or the analytical comparison contrast conclusion. So with a proficiency in structuring, one unlocks the potential for creativity and expressiveness. Familiarity with a chosen structure allows for strategic pauses to delve deeper, innovate, or explore, all while maintaining direction and focus. So one of Abraham's all-time favorite structures is what, so what, now what, due to its simplicity and adaptability. This approach begins with presenting an idea, topic, product, service, or argument, which is the what, followed by an explanation of its significance, utility, or relevance, the brackets of so what, and concludes it with the suggestion for future action or application by the audience, so the now what. Abraham regards the what, so what, now what structure as the Swiss Army knife of frameworks, advocating for its mastery as a versatile tool in any communicator's arsenal. If one is to focus on one, on learning and remembering, sorry, just one structure, this would be his choice. And you can see why. It kind of, you can write essays based off that. I mean, if you think a lot of self-help books, in fact, his book in general was kind of very much like that. It was like, what, here is like why you need to manage the what of anxiety. So what, this is why it's relevant, because if you don't, you're going to have these problems, but this is what it's going to solve. Now what, here's a like an actionable checklist of the strategies you can use. And it's quite funny because you can, yeah, pretty much structure most things in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then this was another key idea I took out, which I really quite enjoyed. And it's kind of like a sub note, is this idea of repeatability. So Raymond Nasser is a seasoned communication consultant with a notable clientele in the tech sector. He frequently assists entrepreneurs in preparing for crucial meetings with venture capitalists to seek funding for their corporations. So Nasser highlights repeatability as a key advantage of using a narrative structure in presentations. He points out that the venture capitalist an entrepreneur presents to often isn't the decision maker for the funding. So the individual must relay the pitch to their colleagues. A compelling story told by the entrepreneur is more likely to be remembered and crucially repeated accurately by the venture capitalist to others within the firm. This ease of repetition enhances the likelihood of the story resonating with the subsequent listeners. So Nasser observes that over time, the ability to repeat a story transforms a simple narrative into a form of mythology, passed down and gaining significance with each retelling. And I thought that's really interesting, because if you can bake, it's almost like the made to stick kind of thing. If you can bake in repeatability into an idea or a story you create, it's more likely to be shared. So yeah, so some classic all-purpose structures. So you got the, as mentioned before, the what, so what, now what. So discuss the topic, why it matters, and then the practical implications. You've got the next one called prep, which is point, reason, example, point. So you make a point, give the rationale behind it, offer some illustrations, wrap up by returning to the point. Then you've got the problem, solution, benefit, which is usually used for pitches and sales. So you evoke an issue or bring attention to a problem. You then offer the solution and end by discussing the benefit that your solution would confer. Then you've got the comparison, contrast, conclusion. So when making a comparison, but begin by reflecting on the similarities, then the differences, and then you wrap up your speech by coming to a conclusion. And then one of the very last ones he's got here as a general all purpose is the STAR, which is situation, task, action, result. I think I use this at uni actually. So describe an event that just transpired or evoke a situation, discuss the challenge you had and what you did to address it, and then you end with a discussion of the results you obtained. And that's, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's quite a good one as well for like interviewing, to explain, obviously, you know, how you showcased, I don't know, perseverance or some of these other ethereal, that's the one. Character qualities, you know, you've given it like a tangible action and challenge you did.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, I guess your uni did teach you one then.
Yeah, there you go. I don't think they called it like that, but yeah, it definitely was star, for sure. I remember it.
All right, so then on to the next point.
Good old days.
How to implement structures. Practice, practice, practice. The first step in learning how to apply structure spontaneously is to do it again and again and again. Consider practicing impromptu speaking through online resources. For example, Toastmasters offers a tool for generating questions for practice responses, while Google provides random questions for interview prep. Additionally, you can use generative AI tools like ChatGPT to receive prompts, then craft your own responses using the what, now what structure as your guide. So, give it a try. Next time you're engaging with the news, reading a book, or consuming any form of written content, challenge yourself to think of a brief presentation in your head. Use the what, so what, now what structure. Identify what the content was about, why it's significant or relevant to you, and how you can apply this information in the future. I mean, that makes sense. All of this stuff is just practice. And we talked about it with the art of explanation, but you just want to keep doing it more and more and more so you become more familiar with the different techniques and the different structures and, you know, in specific contexts, whatever it is that you're talking about. But the more you practice it, the more familiar you become with it. And, you know, I think in the last one, he was talking about verbalization. So, you know, speak it out loud.
Eventually, so hopefully, it becomes second nature. You know, that's like, I guess, the aim.
Yeah.
So you don't think about it; you just do it.
Yeah, yeah. So then you want to, and moving on to the next point, stockpile your stories. So Raymond Nasser advises his clients to prepare by gathering a collection of memorable stories, creating a reserve of anecdotes ready for use in various situations. He emphasizes that the goal isn't to memorize these tales verbatim, but to have a stockpile of stories at their fingertips for moments that demand quick thinking. Many leading figures in the tech industry whom Nasser has guided keep such a repertoire of narratives to draw upon as needed, tailoring their storytelling to the specific context. And this I like 100% resonate with. I would love to like create a bank of stories that are just in my phone, but the more you talk about them, the more you bring them up, the easier and the more accessible they are. I mean, we all have certain stories that we use to, I don't know, anecdotally as like an analogy, you know, to convey a point across that we find important. And we, you know, I've done it where you tell it to someone and then both you and that person go and see another person. That person tells the same exact story to the other person. It's just this kind of example that they constantly use. And the more stories at your, you know, at your disposal, the better, essentially. I think it's a very good point to have. So the story spine exercise, originating from improvisational theater, is an excellent method for practicing how to frame information narratively. To use it, complete the prompt by outlining a scenario that specifies characters, as well as the time and place. So, for example, once upon a time, insert character in place. Every day, describe normal life. But one day, insert event. This happened. Because of that, insert another event happened. And so on and so forth. So using these kind of formats, it creates two or three narratives. Are you starting to get more of a feel for storytelling? The more you do this, the easier it will be to create narratives on the spot.
Yeah, quite like that story spine.
Yeah,
it's a good sort of like, it's very basic, but it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's just this happened and this happened and this happened and this happened until finally this happened. You know, it's kind of the natural way we tell stories anyway. You know, I went there, then this happened, then I went there and this happened, then this happened, then, you know, or whatever. So like, it's, you know, it's, I feel like it's a fairly normal way we all do it, but it gives it a bit of structure. And you can maybe go back and revisit your life and create a few stories off the back of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're now moving on to chapter six, which is the very last part of the six steps framework, and it will be the last part of this video. And we'll definitely do a second part to cover part two, which is the application of all these ideas. So number six is focus, the F word of spontaneous speaking. So effective communication, whether planned or off the cuff, is all about being clear and to the point. It delivers exactly what the audience needs to understand the message without unnecessary details, confusing terms, or long-winded explanations. Think about times when you've been stuck listening to a story at a social event that just drags on with so much extra information you forget the point. Or when company leaders give answers that are more puzzling than helpful, which obviously happens a lot. Or when people avoid giving a straight answer, make up excuses, or try too hard to prove they know what they're talking about, or just plain right talk too much. So, like with any skill, a little practice in structuring your thoughts can significantly improve your ability to communicate clearly on the spot. In Matt's experience, working with clients and students, he's found that focus messages share four key traits. They're precise, relevant, easy to understand, and brief. If you can work on these aspects, you'll naturally become better at engaging your audience. So, dimension number one is precision. So, what's the point exactly? And the bottom line is, have a clear goal. Being precise in communication means having a clear goal for your message and tailoring your words to achieve it. Often we only have a vague idea of what we aim to accomplish, making it hard to decide both what to say, both what to say and what to leave out. So having a clear understanding of three communication goals, knowledge, emotion, and action, can significantly enhance the impact of our communication. It helps audiences understand our message more clearly and allows us to navigate various situations more effectively, avoiding potential misunderstandings. Before entering a situation where you might have to speak without preparation, take a moment to consider three critical questions. So, what do you want your audience to know? How do you want them to feel? And what action do you want them to take? While many people focus on the information and emotional response they want to generate, the call to action is often overlooked. This is especially true in informal settings, such as a Q&A session with entrepreneurs, who may clearly present their company's mission and achievements and aim to stir interest and excitement, but fail to specify the actions they desire from the audience. So consider how you gauge the success of your communication. Will your audience grasp the ideas you're presenting? Will they show signs of feeling the way you intend? Or will they commit to a certain level of support or take a specific number of actions? So moving on from precision. Dimension two is relevance. Why should I care? And the bottom line is focus on the importance and salience of your speech for your audience. So the most impactful and engaging messages are those that the audience finds directly applicable to their lives. These messages resonate because they align with the audience's identity, desires, necessities, essentially answering the ever-present question, why should this matter to me? When unexpectedly asked to speak, take a brief moment to consider, who is my audience? What do they need to understand from my response? And how can I present my answer to make it most relevant, captivating, or pressing for them? Finding common ground and making your idea resonate can also be achieved by intentionally sparking curiosity or creating a sense of anticipation. So give this a try. During your next impromptu interaction, aim to pique your audience's interest in a way that makes the discussion seem more pertinent and immediate. If you're asked a question, introduce a slight element of suspense by outlining a significant consequence or challenge that your forthcoming response will tackle. Then proceed with your explanation. If you're initiating the conversation about an idea, generate curiosity by posing a provocative question yourself before providing the answer. For instance, if you need to discuss the introduction of a new product spontaneously, you might start by asking, is it in our best interest to manage two products in the market simultaneously? And I quite like that, actually, the idea of practicing that. And it kind of reminds me, we talked about it a few times before, like introducing some sort of like... blanket provocative statement before you start speaking, like, before I answer, this is gonna blow your mind, and then you go into your answer. Kind of thing gives them that like suspense, you know.
Exactly. It seems like a lot of these are very much in line with the anatomy of an explanation, you know, the kind of process. Like,
I was gonna say to you, like, we did the same with obviously the health books. We're obviously reading every single communication book here. We are going to discover, I feel like, very similar points across these books. And it's good that we have, because it just means in my head, if these different people for different, I mean, obviously he's mainly around impromptu speaking, so being put on the spot. And obviously Art of Explanation is kind of similar, but not really, in the sense there's way more preparation involved, right? but it kind of makes me like, you know, they're all converging on the same points of communication, which just goes to show that you would assume they're like underlying principles.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. Yeah, it's good. All right. So then on to dimension three, accessibility. Why is this stuff so complicated? And the bottom line is make your content understandable by avoiding jargon and acronyms. Complexity often obstructs important conversations. This complexity arises when individuals attempt to demonstrate their expertise or fall victim to the curse of knowledge, assuming their audience has a similar level of understanding. This leads to the use of specialized language that can be confusing for many. Matt Abrahams emphasizes the role of communicators as translators who should simplify complex ideas into clear, straightforward language accessible to everyone. A focus on making messages more understandable can significantly enhance the effectiveness of communication, especially in spontaneous situations. When explaining technology to less tech-savvy individuals, Abraham advocates for what could be termed the grandmother test. This approach involves reducing the use of technical jargon and simplifying explanations to make the technology comprehensible to someone with minimal knowledge of modern gadgets. Abrahams also suggests that, similar to preparing stories for unexpected speaking opportunities, it's beneficial to think ahead about strategies for breaking down complex ideas. Strategies might include employing vivid analogies, preparing simple visuals for use with a whiteboard, or distilling the concept into a few basic, easily understandable parts or steps, akin to the approach Kessler took with lit charts. And then on to dimension four. So concision. Why are they so long-winded? And the bottom line is be crisp. Matt Abrahams learned an important lesson on communication, simplicity from parenting strategies. Minimal words. Rather than offering lengthy explanations when asking his children to do something, a straightforward instruction, join us at 7 p.m. for dinner, clean up your room, proves more effective. This approach minimizes the chances for objections and prolonged discussion. Neurologist Joseph Parvizi explains to Abrahams that conciseness makes messages easier to process as it reduces the cognitive load on the brain. Using fewer words can enhance connection with audiences and maintain their focus. In a time when attention spans are short, and they are bloody, bloody short, it's crucial to evaluate the necessity of every piece of our message. By focusing on the essence of communication, we can significantly boost the impact of our messages. It's our responsibility to make understanding as straightforward, enjoyable, and engaging as possible for our audience. So an exercise could be, consider a complex activity you do regularly, such as putting a child to bed, shuffling cards, making your favorite dish, or negotiating a deal. Try to think of a metaphor or an analogy for this task. Example, putting a child to bed is like... Practice explaining this activity in front of a mirror or camera using your metaphor or analogy. Does this approach simplify the explanation and reduce the number of words needed?
It's quite a fun exercise, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
It's like this, it's like that. It's, you know, as we know from metaphors, you can, you know, extract or bring to the forefront certain elements of the experience and then hide others. But I think it would be quite fun to just sit there and come up with as many metaphors as possible. Like, you know, putting your kids to bed is like ... and just coming up with like 5-10 different answers, and get better at trying to pull metaphors out your ass as you go.
Yeah.
You know, because it can be quite funny and quite witty if you do it well, I think.
I think it's also quite impressive when you see someone who actually like whips out a metaphor that you're like, okay.
Wow, yeah, no, it 100% is, man. It's a bit like, you know how you wanted that? You stuck on the point earlier about having like a story stockpile. Like you want a metaphor mine. You want loads of metaphors that you can just go back to and always use kind of thing. But like, not always use, but you get, I mean, if you have like enough, you can then just whip them out here and then when you need it.
Exactly.
So yeah, anyway, we're going to finish off with a summary of these four dimensions. So number one, be clear. What is your goal? So the key point is you know your message's purpose, to inform, inspire, action, or evoke emotion. You got to be precise, clearly define what you want your audience to know, feel, and do. And this clarity will improve your message's impact, making it more understandable and actionable. So before speaking, you need to quickly think, what should they learn? How should they feel? And what action should they take? Number two, make it matter. Why this matters to you. The key point is your message should resonate personally with your audience. Messages hit home when they align with your audience's interests and needs. So consider their perspective to make your points relevant and engaging. Try creating a hook that makes the topic immediately interesting or important to your audience. Use suspense or pose a question to draw them in. Number three, keep it simple. Let's not complicate things. So the key point is to avoid jargon and speak plainly. You want to simplify the complex ideas, assume your audience isn't familiar with technical terms, use analogies or break down concepts into easy to understand pieces. Think about how you'd explain a complex topic to someone without your expertise, aiming for clarity and accessibility. And then number four, which is get to the point, keep it short. Key point, be concise, more isn't always better. Use minimal words for maximum effect. Clear, direct statements are easier for audiences to grasp and remember. Prioritize your message's core, eliminate unnecessary details to keep your audience focused and engaged. I did quite like the point you made there before about the whole, you know, join us for dinner at 7 if you want or whatever, or just join us at 7, join us for dinner at 7. Like you give them no option to, you know, get out. It's almost like a direct command, almost kind of thing. But I do see the difference when you're too kind. You give them too much rope to make up excuses, right? It's just like, join us there at 7, see ya.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah, so those were the six steps for spontaneous communication. I'm going to get back up to find the list because we've gone through so many. So you've got the calm, which is the anxiety, the unlock, redefine, listen, structure. And then the last one, which we just covered, was focus. In part two, which we will probably do in the next couple of days, it's all about the application of the principles we've just learned to specific scenarios. Mm. So you've got scenarios such as making a pitch, an impromptu toast, which I'm sure everybody's probably scared of, you know, being like, oh, make a toast to this person or whatever, doing a great Q&A. Apologies. So there's plenty to get stuck into, and there's a framework for each of them. And yeah, it should be out at a similar time. So we'll do that next.
Yes, absolutely. Looking forward to it.
And that is a wrap.